Barker answered angrily. "It's only the facts that we want. It is in your interest and everyone's interest that they should be cleared up. Did Mr. Douglas entirely approve your friendship with his wife?" Barker grew paler, and his great, strong hands were clasped convulsively together. "You have no right to ask such questions," he cried. "What has this to do with the matter you are investigating?"
"I must repeat the question."
"Well, I refuse to answer."
"You can refuse to answer, but you must be aware that your refusal is in itself an answer, for you would not refuse if you had not something to conceal."
Barker stood for a moment with his face set grimly and his strong black eyebrows drawn low in intense thought. Then he looked up with a smile. "Well, I guess you gentlemen are only doing your clear duty, after all, and I have no right to stand in the way of it. I'd only ask you not to worry Mrs. Douglas over this matter, for she has enough upon her just now. I may tell you that poor Douglas had just one fault in the world, and that was his jealousy. He was fond of me. Oh, no man could be fonder of a friend. And he was devoted to his wife. He loved me to come here, and was forever sending for me. And yet if his wife and I talked together, or there seemed any sympathy between us, a kind of wave of jealousy would pass over him, and he would be off the handle and saying the wildest things in a moment. More than once I've sworn off coming for that reason, and then he would write me such penitent, imploring letters that I just had to. But you can take it from me, gentlemen, if it was my last word, that no man ever had a more loving, faithful wife. And, I can say also, no friend could be more loyal than I." It was spoken with fervour and feeling, and yet Inspector MacDonald could not dismiss the subject. "You are aware," said he, "that the dead man's wedding ring has been taken from his finger."
"So it appears," said Barker.
"What do you mean by appears? You know it as a fact." The man seemed confused and undecided. "When I said appears, I meant that it was conceivable that he had himself taken off the ring. The mere fact that the ring should be absent, whoever may have removed it, would suggest to anyone's mind, would it not, that the marriage and the tragedy were connected." Barker shrugged his broad shoulders. "I can't profess to say what it means," he answered. "But if you mean to hint that it could reflect in any way upon this lady's honour—" His eyes blazed for an instant, and then with an evident effort he got a grip upon his own emotions. "Well, you are on the wrong track, that's all."
"I don't know that I've anything else to ask you at present," said MacDonald coldly.
"There was one small point," remarked Sherlock Holmes. "When you entered the room, there was only a candle lighted on the table, was there not?"
"Yes, that was so."
"By its light you saw that some terrible incident had occurred?"
"Exactly."
"You at once rang for help?"
"Yes."
"And it arrived very speedily?"
"Within a minute or so."
"And yet when they arrived, they found that the candle was out and that the lamp had been lighted. That seems very remarkable."
Again, Barker showed some signs of indecision.
"I don't see that it was remarkable, Mr. Holmes," he answered after a pause. "The candle threw a very bad light. My first thought was to get a better one. The lamp was on the table, so I lit it."
"And blew out the candle?"
"Exactly."
Holmes asked no further question, and Barker, with a deliberate look from one to the other of us, which had, as it seemed to me, something of defiance in it, turned and left the room. Inspector MacDonald had sent up a note to the effect that he would wait upon Mrs. Douglas in her room, but she had replied that she would meet us in the dining room. She entered now, a tall and beautiful woman of 30, reserved and self-possessed to a remarkable degree, very different from the tragic and distracted figure I had pictured. It is true that her face was pale and drawn, like that of one who has endured a great shock. But her manner was composed, and the finely moulded hand which she rested upon the edge of the table was as steady as my own. Her sad, appealing eyes travelled from one to the other of us with a curiously inquisitive expression. That questioning gaze transformed itself suddenly into abrupt speech. "Have you found anything out yet?" she asked. Was it by imagination that there was an undertone of fear rather than of hope in the question? "We have taken every possible step, Mrs. Douglas," said the inspector. "You may rest assured that nothing will be neglected." "Spare no money," she said in a dead, even tone. "It is my desire that every possible effort should be made." "Perhaps you can tell us something which may throw some light upon the matter."
"I fear not, but all I know is at your service."
"We have heard from Mr. Cecil Barker that you did not actually see, that you were never in the room where the tragedy occurred."
"No, he turned me back upon the stairs. He begged me to return to my room."
"Quite so. You had heard the shot, and you had at once come down."
"I put on my dressing gown and then came down."
"How long was it after hearing the shot that you were stopped on the stair by Mr. Barker?"
"It may have been a couple of minutes. It is so hard to reckon time at such a moment. He implored me not to go on. He assured me that I could do nothing. Then Mrs. Allen, the housekeeper, led me upstairs again. It was all like some dreadful dream."
"Can you give us any idea how long your husband had been downstairs before you heard the shot?"
"No, I cannot say. He went from his dressing-room, and I did not hear him go. He did the round of the house every night, for he was nervous of fire. It is the only thing that I have ever known him nervous of."
"That is just the point which I want to come to, Mrs. Douglas. You have known your husband only in England, have you not?"
"Yes, we have been married 5 years."
"Have you heard him speak of anything which occurred in America and might bring some danger upon him?" Mrs. Douglas thought earnestly before she answered.
"Yes," she said at last. "I have always felt that there was a danger hanging over him. He refused to discuss it with me. It was not from want of confidence in me. There was the most complete love and confidence between us, but it was out of his desire to keep all alarm away from me. He thought I should brood over it if I knew all, and so he was silent."
"How did you know it, then?" Mrs. Douglas's face lit with a quick smile.
"Can a husband ever carry about a secret all his life, and a woman who loves him have no suspicion of it? I knew it by his refusal to talk about some episodes in his American life. I knew it by certain precautions he took. I knew it by certain words he let fall. I knew it by the way he looked at unexpected strangers. I was perfectly certain that he had some powerful enemies, that he believed they were on his track, and that he was always on his guard against them. I was so sure of it that for years I have been terrified if ever he came home later than was expected."
"Might I ask," asked Holmes,
"what the words were which attracted your attention?" "The Valley of Fear,"
the lady answered.
"That was an expression he has used when I questioned him. I have been in the Valley of Fear. I am not out of it yet." "Are we never to get out of the Valley of Fear?" I have asked him, when I have seen him more serious than usual. "Sometimes I think that we never shall," he has answered.
"Surely you asked him what he meant by the Valley of Fear?"
"I did, but his face would become very grave, and he would shake his head. 'It is bad enough that one of us should have been in its shadow,' he said. 'Please God, it shall never fall upon you.' It was some real valley in which he had lived, and in which something terrible had occurred to him. Of that I am certain, but I can tell you no more."
"And he never mentioned any names?"
"Yes, He was delirious with fever once when he had his hunting accident 3 years ago. Then I remembered that there was a name that came continually to his lips. He spoke it with anger and a sort of horror. McGinty was the name. Bodymaster McGinty. I asked him when he recovered who Bodymaster McGinty was and whose body he was master of. "Never of mine, thank God," he answered with a laugh. And that was all I could get from him. But there is a connection between Bodymaster McGinty and the Valley of Fear.
"There is one other point," said Inspector MacDonald. "You met Mr. Douglas in a boarding-house in London, did you not, and became engaged to him there? Was there any romance, anything secret or mysterious about the wedding?"
"There was romance. There is always romance. There was nothing mysterious."
"He had no rival?"
"No, I was quite free."
"You have heard, no doubt, that his wedding ring has been taken. Does that suggest anything to you? Suppose that some enemy of his old life had tracked him down and committed this crime. What possible reason could he have for taking his wedding ring?"
For an instant I could have sworn that the faintest shadow of a smile flickered over the woman's lips.
"I really cannot tell," she answered. "It is certainly a most extraordinary thing." "Well, we will not detain you any longer, and we are sorry to have put you to this trouble at such a time," said the inspector. "There are some other points, no doubt, but we can refer to you as they arise." She rose, and I was again conscious of that quick, questioning glance with which she had just surveyed us.
"What impression has my evidence made upon you?"
The question might as well have been spoken. Then, with a bow, she swept from the room. "She's a beautiful woman, a very beautiful woman," said MacDonald thoughtfully, after the door had closed behind her. "This man Barker has certainly been down here a good deal. He is a man who might be attractive to a woman. He admits that the dead man was jealous, and maybe he knew best himself what cause he had for jealousy. Then there's that wedding ring. You can't get past that. The man who tears a wedding ring off a dead man's... What do you say to it, Mr. Holmes?" My friend had sat with his head upon his hands, sunk in the deepest thought. Now he rose and rang the bell. "Ames," he said when the butler entered, "where is Mr. Cecil Barker now?"
"I'll see, sir."
He came back in a moment to say that Barker was in the garden. "Can you remember, Ames, what Mr. Barker had on his feet last night when you joined him in the study?"
"Yes, Mr. Holmes. He had a pair of bedroom slippers. I brought him his boots when he went for the police."
"Where are the slippers now?"
"They are still under the chair in the hall."
"Very good, Ames. It is, of course, important for us to know which tracks may be Mr. Barker's and which from outside."
"Yes, sir. I may say that I noticed that the slippers were stained with blood. So, indeed, were my own."
"That is natural enough, considering the condition of the room. Very good, Ames. We will ring if we want you." A few minutes later, we were in the study. Holmes had brought with him the carpet slippers from the hall. As Ames had observed, the soles of both were dark with blood.
"Strange," murmured Holmes, as he stood in the light of the window and examined them minutely. "Very strange indeed."
Stooping with one of his quick feline pounces, he placed the slipper upon the blood mark on the sill. It exactly corresponded. He smiled in silence at his colleagues. The inspector was transfigured with excitement. His native accent rattled like a stick upon railings. "Man," he cried, "there is not a doubt of it. Barker has just marked the window himself. It's a good deal broader than any boot mark."
I mind that you said it was a splay foot, and here's the explanation. But what's the game, Mr. Holmes? What's the game?
Aye, what's the game? My friend repeated thoughtfully.
White Mason chuckled and rubbed his fat hands together in his professional satisfaction.
I said it was a snorter, he cried, and a real snorter it is.
Chapter 6 A Dawning Light. The three detectives had many matters of detail into which to inquire, so I returned alone to our modest quarters at the village inn. But before doing so, I took a stroll in the curious old-world garden which flanked the house. Rows of very ancient yew trees, cut into strange designs, girded it round. Inside was a beautiful stretch of lawn with an old sundial in the middle, the whole effect so soothing and restful that it was welcome to my somewhat jangled nerves. In that deeply peaceful atmosphere one could forget, or remember only as some fantastic nightmare, that darkened study with the sprawling, blood-stained figure on the floor. And yet, as I strolled round it and tried to steep my soul in its gentle balm, a strange incident occurred, which brought me back to the tragedy and left a sinister impression on my mind. I have said that a decoration of yew trees circled the garden. At the end farthest from the house, they thickened into a continuous hedge. On the other side of this hedge, concealed from the eyes of anyone approaching from the direction of the house, there was a stone seat. As I approached the spot, I was aware of voices. Some remark in the deep tones of a man, answered by a little ripple of feminine laughter. An instant later, I had come round the end of the hedge, and my eyes lit upon Mrs. Douglas and the man Barker before they were aware of my presence. Her appearance gave me a shock. In the dining room she had been demure and discreet. Now all pretense of grief had passed away from her. Her eyes shone with the joy of living, and her face still quivered with amusement at some remark of her companion. He sat forward, his hands clasped and his forearms on his knees, with an answering smile upon his bold, handsome face. In an instant, but it was just one instant too late, they resumed their solemn masks as my figure came into view. A hurried word or two passed between them, and then Barker rose and came towards me. "Excuse me, sir," said he, "but am I addressing Dr. Watson?" I bowed with a coldness which showed, I dare say, very plainly the impression which had been produced upon my mind. "We thought that it was probably you, as your friendship with Mr. Sherlock Holmes is so well known. Would you mind coming over and speaking to Mrs. Douglas for one instant?" I followed him with a dour face. Very clearly I could see in my mind's eye that shattered figure on the floor. Here, within a few hours of the tragedy, were his wife and his nearest friend laughing together behind a bush in the garden which had been his. I greeted the lady with reserve. I had grieved with her grief in the dining room. Now I met her appealing gaze with an unresponsive eye. "I fear that you think me callous and hard-hearted," said she. I shrugged my shoulders. "It is no business of mine," said I. "Perhaps some day you will do me justice. If you only realized—" "There is no need why Dr. Watson should realize," said Barker quickly. "As he has himself said, it is no possible business of his."
"Exactly," said I, "and so I will beg leave to resume my walk."
"One moment, Dr. Watson," cried the woman in a pleading voice. "There is one question which you can answer with more authority
than anyone else in the world, and it may make a very great difference to me. You know Mr. Holmes and his relations with the police better than anyone else can. Supposing that a matter were brought confidentially to his knowledge, is it absolutely necessary that he should pass it on to the detectives?
Yes, that's it, said Barker eagerly. Is he on his own, or is he entirely in with them?
I really don't know that I should be justified in discussing such a point.
I beg, I implore that you will, Dr. Watson. I assure you that you will be helping us, helping me greatly, if you will guide us on that point.
There was such a ring of sincerity in the woman's voice that for the instant I forgot all about her levity and was moved only to do her will.
Mr. Holmes is an independent investigator, I said. He is his own master and would act as his own judgment directed. At the same time, he would naturally feel loyalty towards the officials who were working on the same case, and he would not conceal from them anything which would help them in bringing a criminal to justice. Beyond this, I can say nothing, and I would refer you to Mr. Holmes himself if you wanted fuller information. So saying, I raised my hat and went upon my way, leaving them still seated behind that concealing hedge. I looked back as I rounded the far end of it and saw that they were still talking very earnestly together. And as they were gazing after me, it was clear that it was our interview that was the subject of their debate. "I wish none of their confidences," said Holmes, when I reported to him what had occurred. He had spent the whole afternoon at the manor house in consultation with his two colleagues, and returned about five with a ravenous appetite for a high tea, which I had ordered for him. No confidences, Watson, for they are mighty awkward if it comes to an arrest for conspiracy and murder.
You think it will come to that?
He was in his most cheerful and debonair humour.
My dear Watson, when I have exterminated that fourth egg, I shall be ready to put you in touch with the whole situation. I don't say that we have fathomed it, far from it, but when we have traced the missing dumbbell...
The dumbbell?
Dear me, Watson, is it possible that you have not penetrated the fact that the case hangs upon the missing dumbbell?
Well, you need not be downcast, for between ourselves, I don't think that either Inspector Mac or the excellent local practitioner has grasped the overwhelming importance of this incident. One dumbbell, Watson. Consider an athlete with one dumbbell. Picture to yourself the unilateral development, the imminent danger of a spinal curvature. Shocking, Watson, shocking! He sat with his mouth full of toast and his eyes sparkling with mischief, watching my intellectual entanglement. The mere sight of his excellent appetite was an assurance of success, for I had very clear recollections of days and nights without a thought of food, when his baffled mind had chafed before some problem, while his thin, eager features became more attenuated with the asceticism of complete mental concentration. Finally, he lit his pipe, and sitting in the ingle nook of the old village inn, he talked slowly and at random about his case, rather as one who thinks aloud than as one who makes a considered statement. A lie, Watson. Great, big, thumping, obtrusive, uncompromising lie. That's what meets us on the threshold. There is our starting point. The whole story told by Barker is a lie. But Barker's story is corroborated by Mrs. Douglas. Therefore, she is lying also. They are both lying, and in a conspiracy. So now we have the clear problem. Why are they lying? And what is the truth which they are trying so hard to conceal? Let us try, Watson, you and I, if we can get behind the lie and reconstruct the truth. How do I know that they are lying?
Because it is a clumsy fabrication which simply could not be true. Consider. According to the story given to us, the assassin had less than a minute after the murder had been committed to take that ring, which was under another ring, from the dead man's finger, to replace the other ring, a thing which he would surely never have done, and to put that singular card beside his victim. I say that this was obviously impossible. You may argue, but I have too much respect for your judgment, Watson, to think that you will do so, that the ring may have been taken before the man was killed. The fact that the candle had been lit only a short time shows that there had been no lengthy interview. Was Douglas, from what we hear of his fearless character, a man who would be likely to give up his wedding ring at such short notice? Or could we conceive of his giving it up at all? No, no, Watson. The assassin was alone with the dead man for some time with the lamp lit. Of that, I have no doubt at all. But the gunshot was apparently the cause of death. Therefore, the shot must have been fired some time earlier than we are told. But there could be no mistake about such a matter as that. We are in the presence, therefore, of a deliberate conspiracy upon the part of the two people who heard the gunshot, of the man Barker and of the woman Douglas. When, on the top of this, I am able to show that the blood mark on the windowsill was deliberately placed there by Barker in order to give a false clue to the police, you will admit that the case grows dark against him. Now we have to ask ourselves at what hour the murder actually did occur. Up to 10:30, the servants were moving about the house, so it was certainly not before that time. At 11:15, they had all gone to their rooms, with the exception of Ames, who was in the pantry. I've been trying some experiments after you left us this afternoon, and I find that no noise which MacDonald can make in the study can penetrate to me in the pantry when all the doors are shut. It is otherwise, however, from the housekeeper's room. It is not so far down the corridor, and from it I could vaguely hear a voice when it was very loudly raised. The sound from a shotgun is to some extent muffled when the discharge is at very close range, as it undoubtedly was in this instance. It would not be very loud, and yet in the silence of the night it should have easily penetrated to Mrs. Allen's room. She is, as she has told us, somewhat deaf, but nonetheless she mentioned in her evidence that she did hear something like a door slamming 30 minutes before the alarm was given. 30 minutes before the alarm was given would be 11:15. I have no doubt that what she heard was the report of the gun, and that this was the real instant of the murder. If this is so, we have now to determine what Barker and Mrs. Douglas, presuming that they are not the actual murderers, could have been doing from 10:45, when the sound of the shot brought them down, until 11:15, when they rang the bell and summoned the servants. What were they doing? And why did they not instantly give the alarm? That is the question which faces us, and when it has been answered, we shall surely have gone some way to solve our problem.
I am convinced myself, said I, that there is an understanding between those two people. She must be a heartless creature to sit laughing at some jest within a few hours of her husband's murder.
Exactly. She does not shine as a wife, even in her own account of what occurred. I am not a whole-souled admirer of womankind, as you are aware, Watson, but my experience of life has taught me that there are few wives, having any regard for their husbands, who would let any man's spoken word stand between them and that husband's dead body. Should I ever marry, Watson, I should hope to inspire my wife with some feeling which would prevent her from being walked off by a housekeeper when my corpse was lying within a few yards of her. It was badly stage-managed, for even the rawest investigators must be struck by the absence of the usual feminine ululation. If there had been nothing else, this incident alone
would have suggested a prearranged conspiracy to my mind.
You think, then, definitely, that Barker and Mrs. Douglas are guilty of the murder?
There is an appalling directness about your questions, Watson, said Holmes, shaking his pipe at me. They come at me like bullets. If you put it that Mrs. Douglas and Barker know the truth about the murder and are conspiring to conceal it, then I can give you a whole-souled answer. I am sure they do. But your more deadly proposition is not so clear. Let us for a moment consider the difficulties which stand in the way. We will suppose that this couple are united by the bonds of a guilty love, and that they have determined to get rid of the man who stands between them. It is a large supposition, for discreet inquiry among servants and others has failed to corroborate it in any way. On the contrary, there's a good deal of evidence that the Douglases were very attached to each other.
That, I am sure, cannot be true, said I, thinking of the beautiful, smiling face in the garden.
Well, at least they gave that impression. However, we will suppose that they are an extraordinarily astute couple who deceive everyone upon this point and conspire to murder the husband. He happens to be a man over whose head some danger hangs.
Well, we only have their word for that.
Holmes looked thoughtful. I see, Watson. You are sketching out a theory by which everything they say from the beginning is false. According to your idea, there was never any hidden menace or secret society or valley of fear or Boss McSomebody or anything else. Well, that is a good sweeping generalization. Let us see what that brings us to. They invent this theory to account for the crime. They then play up to the idea by leaving this bicycle in the park as proof of the existence of some outsider. The stain on the windowsill conveys the same idea. So does the card on the body, which might have been prepared in the house. That all fits into your hypothesis, Watson. But now we come on the nasty, angular, uncompromising bits which won't slip into their places. Why a cut-off shotgun, of all weapons, and an American one at that? How could they be so sure that the sound of it would not bring someone on to them? It's a mere chance, as it is, that Mrs. Allen did not start out to inquire for the slamming door. Why did your guilty couple do all this, Watson?
I confess that I can't explain it.
Then again, if a woman and her lover conspire to murder a husband, are they going to advertise their guilt by ostentatiously removing his wedding ring after his death? Does that strike you as very probable, Watson?
No, it does not.
And once again, if the thought of leaving a bicycle concealed outside had occurred to you, would it really have seemed worth doing when the dullest detective would naturally say this is an obvious blind, as the bicycle is the first thing which the fugitive needed in order to make his escape?
I can conceive of no explanation.
And yet there should be no combination of events for which the wit of man cannot conceive an explanation. Simply as a mental exercise, without any assertion that it is true, let me indicate a possible line of thought. It is, I admit, mere imagination, but how often is imagination the mother of truth? We will suppose that there was a guilty secret, a really shameful secret in the life of this man, Douglas. This leads to his murder by someone who is, we will suppose, an avenger, someone from outside. This avenger, for some reason which I confess I am still at a loss to explain, took the dead man's wedding ring. The vendetta might conceivably date back to the man's first marriage and the ring be taken for some such reason. Before this avenger got away, Barker and the wife had reached the room. The assassin convinced them that any attempt to arrest him would lead to the publication of some hideous scandal. They were converted to this idea and preferred to let him go. For this purpose, they probably lowered the bridge, which can be done quite noiselessly, and then raised it again. He made his escape and, for some reason, thought that he could do so more safely on foot than on the bicycle. He therefore left his machine where it would not be discovered until he had got safely away. So far we are within the bounds of possibility, are we not?
Well, it is possible, no doubt, said I, with some reserve.
We have to remember, Watson, that whatever occurred is certainly something very extraordinary. Well, now, to continue our supposititious case, the couple, not necessarily a guilty couple, realize after the murderer is gone that they have placed themselves in a position in which it may be difficult for them to prove that they did not themselves either do the deed or connive at it. They rapidly and rather clumsily met the situation. The mark was put by Barker's blood-stained slipper upon the window-sill to suggest how the fugitive got away. They obviously were the two who must have heard the sound of the gun, so they gave the alarm exactly as they would have done, but a good half hour after the event.
And how do you propose to prove all this?
Well, if there were an outsider, he may be traced and taken. That would be the most effective of all proofs. But if not, well, the resources of science are far from being exhausted. I think that an evening alone in that study would help me much.
An evening alone?
I propose to go up there presently. I have arranged it with the estimable Ames, who is by no means wholehearted about Barker. I shall sit in that room and see if its atmosphere brings me inspiration. I'm a believer in the genius loci. You smile, friend Watson. Well, we shall see. By the way, you have that big umbrella of yours, have you not?
It is here.
Well, I'll borrow that, if I may.
Certainly, but what a wretched weapon. If there's any danger...
Nothing serious, my dear Watson, or I should certainly ask for your assistance, but I'll take the umbrella. At present I'm only awaiting the return of our colleagues from Tunbridge Wells, where they are at present engaged in trying for a likely owner to the bicycle. It was nightfall before Inspector MacDonald and White Mason came back from their expedition, and they arrived exultant, reporting a great advance in our investigation.
"Man, I'll admit that I had my doubts, if there ever was an outsider," said MacDonald. "But that's all past now. We've had the bicycle identified, and we have a description of our man, so that's a long step on our journey."
"Sounds to me like the beginning of the end," said Holmes. "I'm sure I congratulate you both with all my heart."
"Well, I started from the fact that Mr. Douglas had seemed disturbed since the day before, when he had been in Tunbridge Wells. It was at Tunbridge Wells, then, that he had become conscious of some danger. It was clear, therefore, that if a man had come over with a bicycle, it was from Tunbridge Wells that he might be expected to have come. We took the bicycle over with us and showed it at the hotels. It was identified at once by the manager of the Eagle Commercial as belonging to a man named Hargrave, who had taken a room there 2 days before. This bicycle and a small valise were his whole belongings. He had registered his name as coming from London, but had given no address. The valise was London-made, and the contents were British, but the man himself was undoubtedly an American.
"Well, well," said Holmes gleefully, "you have indeed done some solid work while I've been sitting spinning theories with my friend. It's a lesson in being practical, Mr. Mac."
"Aye, that's just that, Mr. Holmes," said the inspector with satisfaction.
"But this may fit in with your theories," I remarked.
"That may or may not be. But let us hear the end, Mr. Mac. Was there nothing to identify this man?"
"So little that it was evident that he had carefully guarded himself against identification. There were no papers or letters, and no marking upon the clothes.
A cycle map of the county lay on his bedroom table. He had left the hotel after breakfast yesterday morning on his bicycle, and no more was heard of him until our inquiries.
"That's what puzzles me, Mr. Holmes," said White Mason. "If the fellow did not want the hue and cry raised over him, one would imagine that he would have returned and remained at the hotel as an inoffensive tourist. As it is, he must know that he will be reported to the police by the hotel manager and that his disappearance will be connected with the murder."
"So one would imagine. Still, he has been justified of his wisdom up to date, at any rate, since he has not been taken. But his description, what of that?"
MacDonald referred to his notebook.
"Here we have it, so far as they could give it. They don't seem to have taken any very particular stock of him, but still the porter, the clerk, and the chambermaid are all agreed that this about covers the points. He was a man about 5'9" in height, 50 or so years of age, his hair slightly grizzled, a greyish moustache, a curved nose, and a face which all of them described as fierce and forbidding."
"Well, bar the expression, that might almost be a description of Douglas himself," said Holmes. "He is just over 50, with grizzled hair and moustache, and about the same height. Did you get anything else?"
"He was dressed in a heavy grey suit with a reefer jacket, and he wore a short yellow overcoat and a soft cap."
"And what about the shotgun?"
"It is less than 2 feet long. It could very well have fitted into his valise. He could have carried it inside his overcoat without difficulty."
"And how do you consider that all this bears upon the general case?"
"Well, Mr. Holmes," said MacDonald, "when we have got our man, and you may be sure that I had his description on the wires within 5 minutes of hearing it, we shall be better able to judge. But even as it stands, we have surely gone a long way. We know that an American calling himself Hargrave came to Tunbridge Wells 2 days ago with bicycle and valise. In the latter was a sawed-off shotgun, so he came with the deliberate purpose of crime. Yesterday morning he set off for this place on his bicycle, with his gun concealed in his overcoat. No one saw him arrive, so far as we can learn, but he need not pass through the village to reach the park gates. There are many cyclists upon the road. Presumably he had at once concealed his cycle among the laurels where it was found, and possibly lurked there himself with his eye on the house, waiting for Mr. Douglas to come out. The shotgun is a strange weapon to use inside a house, but he had intended to use it outside, and there it has very obvious advantages, as it would be impossible to miss with it, and the sound of shots is so common in an English sporting neighbourhood that no particular notice would be taken."
"That is all very clear," said Holmes.
"Well, Mr. Douglas did not appear. What was he to do next? He left his bicycle and approached the house in the twilight. He found the bridge down and no one about. He took his chance, intending, no doubt, to make some excuse if he met anyone. He met no one. He slipped into the first room that he saw and concealed himself behind the curtain. Thence he could see the drawbridge go up, and he knew that his only escape was through the moat. He waited until 11:15, when Mr. Douglas, upon his usual nightly round, came into the room. He shot him and escaped as arranged. He was aware that the bicycle would be described by the hotel people and be a clue against him, so he left it there and made his way by some other means to London, or to some safe hiding place which he had already arranged. How is that, Mr. Holmes?"
"Well, Mr. Mack, it is very good and very clear so far as it goes. That is your end of the story. My end is that the crime was committed 30 minutes earlier than reported, that Mrs. Douglas and Barker are both in a conspiracy to conceal something, that they aided the murderer's escape, or at least that they reached the room before he escaped, and that they fabricated
evidence of his escape through the window, whereas in all probability they had themselves let him go by lowering the bridge. That's my reading of the first half.
The two detectives shook their heads. "Well, Mr. Holmes, if this is true, we only tumble out of one mystery into another," said the London inspector.
"And in some ways a worse one," added White Mason. "The lady has never been in America in all her life. What possible connection could she have with an American assassin which would cause her to shelter him?"
"I freely admit the difficulties," said Holmes. "I propose to make a little investigation of my own tonight, and it is just possible that it may contribute something to the common cause."
"Can we help you, Mr. Holmes?"
"No, no. Darkness and Dr. Watson's umbrella. My wants are simple. And Ames, the faithful Ames, no doubt he will stretch a point for me. All my lines of thought lead me back invariably to the one basic question. Why should an athletic man develop his frame upon so unnatural an instrument as a single dumbbell?" It was late that night when Holmes returned from his solitary excursion. We slept in a double-bedded room, which was the best that the little country inn could do for us. I was already asleep when I was partly awakened by his entrance.
"Well, Holmes," I murmured, "have you found anything out?"
He stood beside me in silence, his candle in his hand. Then the tall, lean figure inclined towards me. "I say, Watson," he whispered, "would you be afraid to sleep in the same room with a lunatic? A man with softening of the brain? An idiot whose mind has lost its grip?"
"Not in the least," I answered in astonishment.
"Ah, that's lucky," he said, and not another word would he utter that night. Chapter 7 The Solution. Next morning, after breakfast, we found Inspector MacDonald and White Mason seated in close consultation in the small parlour of the local police sergeant. On the table in front of them were piled a number of letters and telegrams, which they were carefully sorting and docketing. Three had been placed on one side.
"Still on the track of the elusive bicyclist?" Holmes asked cheerfully. "What is the latest news of the ruffian?"
MacDonald pointed ruefully to his heap of correspondence.
"He is at present reported from Leicester, Nottingham, Southampton, Derby, East Ham, Richmond, and 14 other places. In 3 of them, East Ham, Leicester, and Liverpool, there is a clear case against him, and he's actually been arrested. The country seems to be full of the fugitives with yellow coats."
"Dear me," said Holmes, sympathetically. "Now, Mr. Mac, and you, Mr. White Mason, I wish to give you a very earnest piece of advice. When I went into this case with you, I bargained, as you will no doubt remember, that I should not present you with half-proved theories, but that I should retain and work out my own ideas until I had satisfied myself that they were correct. For this reason, I am not at the present moment telling you all that is in my mind. On the other hand, I said that I would play the game fairly by you, and I do not think it is a fair game to allow you for one unnecessary moment to waste your energies upon a profitless task. Therefore, I am here to advise you this morning, and my advice to you is summed up in 3 words. Abandon the case."
MacDonald and White Mason stared in amazement at their celebrated colleague.
"You consider it hopeless," cried the inspector.
"I consider your case to be hopeless. I do not consider that it is hopeless to arrive at the truth."
"But the cyclist is not an invention. We have his description, his valise, his bicycle. The fellow must be somewhere. Why should we not get him?"
"Yes, yes, no doubt he is somewhere, and no doubt we shall get him.
but I would not have you waste your energies in East Ham or Liverpool. I am sure that we can find some shorter cut to a result."
"You're holding something back. It's hardly fair of you, Mr. Holmes." The inspector was annoyed.
"You know my methods of work, Mr. Mack. But I will hold it back for the shortest time possible. I only wish to verify my details in one way, which can very readily be done. Then I make my bow and return to London, leaving my results entirely at your service. I owe you too much to act otherwise, for in all my experience I cannot recall any more singular and interesting study."
"This is clean beyond me, Mr. Holmes. We saw you when we returned from Tunbridge Wells last night, and you were in general agreement with our results. What has happened since then to give you a completely new idea of the case?"
"Well, since you ask me, I spent, as I told you I would, some hours last night at the Manor House."
"Well, what happened?"
I can only give you a very general answer to that for the moment. By the way, I've been reading a short but clear and interesting account of the old building, purchasable at the modest sum of one penny from the local tobacconist." Here Holmes drew a small tract, embellished with a rude engraving of the ancient manor house, from his waistcoat pocket. "It immensely adds to the zest of an investigation, my dear Mr. Mack, when one is in conscious sympathy with the historical atmosphere of one's surroundings. Don't look so impatient, for I assure you that even so bald an account as this raises some sort of picture of the past in one's mind. Permit me to give you a sample. Erected in the fifth year of the reign of James I, and standing upon the site of a much older building, the Manor House of Birlstone presents one of the finest surviving examples of the moated Jacobean residence."
"You're making fools of us, Mr. Holmes."
"Tut, tut, Mr. Mack. The first sign of temper I have detected in you. Well, I won't read it verbatim, since you feel so strongly upon the subject, but when I tell you that there is some account of the taking of the place by a parliamentary colonel in 1644, of the concealment of Charles for several days in the course of the Civil War, and finally of a visit there by the second George, you will admit that there are various associations of interest connected with this ancient house."
"I don't doubt it, Mr. Holmes, but that is no business of ours."
"Is it not? Is it not? Breadth of view, my dear Mr. Mack, is one of the essentials of our profession. The interplay of ideas and the oblique uses of knowledge are often of extraordinary interest. You will excuse these remarks from one who, though a mere connoisseur of crime, is still rather older and perhaps more experienced than yourself."
"I'm the first to admit that," said the detective heartily. "You get to your point, I admit, but you have such a deuced round-the-corner way of doing it. Well, well, I'll drop past history and get down to present-day facts. I called last night, as I have already said, at the Manor House. I did not see either Barker or Mrs. Douglas. I saw no necessity to disturb them, but I was pleased to hear that the lady was not visibly pining, and that she had partaken of an excellent dinner. My visit was specially made to the good Mr. Ames, with whom I exchanged some amiabilities, which culminated in his allowing me, without reference to anyone else, to sit alone for a time in the study." "What? With that?" I ejaculated.
"Oh, no, no, everything is now in order. You gave permission for that, Mr. Mack, as I am informed. The room was in its normal state, and in it I passed an instructive quarter of an hour."
"What were you doing?"
"Well, not to make a mystery of so simple a matter, I was looking for the missing dumbbell. It has always bulked rather large in my estimate of the case. I ended by finding it."
"Where?"
"Ah. There we come to the edge of the unexplored. Let me go a little further, a very little further. and I will promise that you shall share everything that I know."
"Well, we're bound to take you on your own terms," said the inspector. "But when it comes to telling us to abandon the case, why in the name of goodness should we abandon the case?"
"For the simple reason, my dear Mr. Mac, that you have not got the first idea what it is that you are investigating."
"We're investigating the murder of Mr. John Douglas of Birlstone Manor."
"Yes, yes, so you are. But don't trouble to trace the mysterious gentleman upon the bicycle. I assure you that it won't help you."
"Then what do you suggest that we do?"
"I will tell you exactly what to do if you will do it."
"Well, I'm bound to say I've always found you had reason behind all your queer ways. I'll do what you advise."
"And you, Mr. White Mason?"
The country detective looked helplessly from one to the other. Holmes and his methods were new to him. "Well, if it's good enough for the inspector, 'tis good enough for me," he said at last.
"Capital," said Holmes. "Well, then, I should recommend a nice, cheery country walk for both of you. They tell me that the views from Birlstone Ridge over the Weald are very remarkable. No doubt lunch could be got at some suitable hostelry, though my ignorance of the country prevents me from recommending one. In the evening, tired but happy—"
"Man, this is getting past a joke," cried MacDonald, rising angrily from his chair.
"Well, well, spend the day as you like," said Holmes, patting him cheerfully upon the shoulder. "Do what you like and go where you will, but meet me here before dusk, without fail, without fail, Mr. Mac."
"That sounds more like sanity."
"All of it was excellent advice, but I don't insist, so long as you are here when I need you. But now, before we part, I want you to write a note to Mr. Barker."
"Well?"
"I'll dictate it, if you like. Ready? "Dear Sir, it has struck me that it is our duty to drain the moat, in the hope that we may find some—"
"It's impossible," said the inspector. "I've made inquiry."
"Tut, tut. My dear sir, please do what I ask you."
Well, go on."
"In the hope that we may find something which may bear upon our investigation. I have made arrangements, and the workmen will be at work early tomorrow morning, diverting the stream—"
"Impossible!"
"Diverting the stream. So I thought it best to explain matters beforehand. Now, sign that and send it by hand about 4 o'clock. At that hour we shall meet again in this room. Until then, we may each do what we like. For I can assure you that this inquiry has come to a definite pause."
Evening was drawing in when we reassembled. Holmes was very serious in his manner, myself curious, and the detectives obviously critical and annoyed.
"Well, gentlemen," said my friend gravely, "I am asking you now to put everything to the test with me, and you will judge for yourselves whether the observations I have made justify the conclusions to which I have come. It is a chill evening, and I do not know how long our expedition may last, so I beg that you will wear your warmest coats. It is of the first importance that we should be in our places before it grows dark, so with your permission we shall get started at once." We passed along the outer bounds of the manor house park until we came to a place where there was a gap in the rails which fenced it. Through this we slipped, and then in the gathering gloom we followed Holmes until we had reached a shrubbery which lies nearly opposite to the main door and the drawbridge. The latter had not been raised. Holmes crouched down behind the screen of laurels, and we all three followed his example.
"Well, what are we to do now?" asked MacDonald with some gruffness.
"Possess our souls in patience and make as little noise as possible," Holmes answered.
What are we here for at all? I really think that you might treat us with more frankness.
Holmes laughed. Watson insists that I am the dramatist in real life, said he. Some touch of the artist wells up within me and calls insistently for a well-staged performance. Surely our profession, Mr. Mac, would be a drab and sordid one if we did not sometimes set the scene so as to glorify our results. The blunt accusation, the brutal tap upon the shoulder, what can one make of such a denouement? But the quick inference, the subtle trap, the clever forecast of coming events, the triumphant vindication of bold theories, are these not the pride and the justification of our life's work? At the present moment you thrill with the glamour of the situation and the anticipation of the hunt. Where would be that thrill if I had been as definite as a timetable? I only ask a little patience, Mr. Mac, and all will be clear to you.
Well, I hope the pride and justification and the rest of it will come before we all get our death of cold, said the London detective with comic resignation.
We all had good reason to join in the aspiration, for our vigil was a long and bitter one. Slowly the shadows darkened over the long, sombre face of the old house. A cold, damp reek from the moat chilled us to the bones and set our teeth chattering. There was a single lamp over the gateway and a steady globe of light in the fatal study. Everything else was dark and still.
"How long is this to last?" asked the inspector finally. "And what is it we are watching for?"
"I have no more notion than you how long it is to last," Holmes answered with some asperity. If criminals would always schedule their movements like railway trains, it would certainly be more convenient for all of us. As to what it is we...
Well, that's what we are watching for.
As he spoke, the bright yellow light in the study was obscured by somebody passing to and fro before it. The laurels among which we lay were immediately opposite the window, and not more than 100 feet from it. Presently it was thrown open with a whining of hinges, and we could dimly see the dark outline of a man's head and shoulders looking out into the gloom. For some minutes he peered forth in furtive, stealthy fashion, as one who wishes to be assured that he is unobserved. Then he leaned forward, and in the intense silence we were aware of the soft lapping of agitated water. He seemed to be stirring up the moat with something which he held in his hand. Then, suddenly, he hauled something in, as a fisherman lands a fish, some large, round object which obscured the light as it was dragged through the open casement.
"Now!" cried Holmes. "Now!"
We were all upon our feet, staggering after him with our stiffened limbs, while he ran swiftly across the bridge and rang violently at the bell. There was the rasping of bolts from the other side, and the amazed Ames stood in the entrance. Holmes brushed him aside without a word, and, followed by all of us, rushed into the room which had been occupied by the man whom we had been watching. The oil lamp on the table represented the glow which we had seen from outside. It was now in the hand of Cecil Barker, who held it towards us as we entered. Its light shone upon his strong, resolute, clean-shaved face and his menacing eyes.
"What the devil is the meaning of all this?" he cried. "What are you after, anyhow?"
Holmes took a swift glance round and then pounced upon a sodden bundle tied together with cord, which lay where it had been thrust under the writing-table.
"This is what we are after, Mr. Barker, this bundle, weighted with a dumbbell, which you have just raised from the bottom of the moat."
Barker stared at Holmes with amazement in his face.
"How in thunder came you to know anything about it?" he asked.
"Simply that I put it there."
"You put it there? You?" Perhaps I should have said replaced it there, said Holmes. You will remember, Inspector MacDonald, that I was somewhat struck by the absence of a dumbbell. I drew your attention to it, but with the pressure of other events you had hardly the time to give it the consideration which would have enabled you to draw deductions from it. When water is near and a weight is missing, it is not a very far-fetched supposition that something has been sunk in the water. The idea was at least worth testing, so with the help of Ames, who admitted me to the room, and the crook of Dr. Watson's umbrella, I was able last night to fish up and inspect this bundle. It was of the first importance, however, that we should be able to prove who placed it there. This we accomplished by the very obvious device of announcing that the moat would be dried tomorrow, which had, of course, the effect that whoever had hidden the bundle would most certainly withdraw it the moment that darkness enabled him to do so. We have no less than 4 witnesses as to who it was who took advantage of the opportunity, and so, Mr. Barker, I think the word lies now with you. Sherlock Holmes put the sopping bundle upon the table beside the lamp and undid the cord which bound it. From within he extracted a dumbbell, which he tossed down to its fellow in the corner. Next he drew forth a pair of boots. American, as you perceive, he remarked, pointing to the toes. Then he laid upon the table a long, deadly, sheathed knife. Finally, he unravelled a bundle of clothing, comprising a complete set of underclothes, socks, a grey tweed suit, and a short yellow overcoat. "The clothes are commonplace," remarked Holmes, "save only the overcoat, which is full of suggestive touches." He held it tenderly towards the light. "Here, as you perceive, is the inner pocket, prolonged into the lining in such fashion as to give ample space for the truncated fowling piece. The tailor's tab is on the neck. Neil, outfitter, Vermissa, USA. I have spent an instructive afternoon in the rector's library, and have enlarged my knowledge by adding the fact that Vermissa is a flourishing little town at the head of one of the best-known coal and iron valleys in the United States. I have some recollection, Mr. Barker, that you associated the coal districts with Mr. Douglas's first wife, and it would surely not be too far-fetched an inference that the VV upon the card by the dead body might stand for Vermissa Valley, or that this very valley, which sends forth emissaries of murder, might be that Valley of Fear of which we have heard. So much is fairly clear. And now, Mr. Barker, I seem to be standing rather in the way of your explanation." It was a sight to see Cecil Barker's expressive face during this exposition of the great detective. Anger, amazement, consternation, and indecision swept over it in turn. Finally, he took refuge in a somewhat acrid irony. "You know such a lot, Mr. Holmes. Perhaps you would better tell us some more," he sneered. "I have no doubt that I could tell you a great deal more, Mr. Barker, but it would come with a better grace from you." "Oh, you think so, do you? Well, all I can say is that if there's any secret here, it is not my secret, and I am not the man to give it away." "Well, if you take that line, Mr. Barker," said the inspector quietly, "we must just keep you in sight until we have the warrant and can hold you." "You can do what you damn well please about that," said Barker defiantly. The proceedings seemed to have come to a definite end so far as he was concerned, for one had only to look at that granite face to realize that no pen forte dur would ever force him to plead against his will. The deadlock was broken, however, by a woman's voice. Mrs. Douglas had been standing listening at the half-open door, and now she entered the room. "You have done enough for now, Cecil," said she. "Whatever comes of it in the future, you have done enough."
"Enough and more than enough," remarked Sherlock Holmes gravely. "I have every sympathy with you, madam, and should strongly urge you to have some confidence in the common sense of our jurisdiction and to take the police voluntarily into your complete confidence. It may be that I am myself at fault for not following up the hint which you conveyed to me through my friend Dr. Watson, but at that time I had every reason to believe that you were directly concerned in the crime. Now I am assured that this is not so. At the same time, there is much that is unexplained, and I should strongly recommend that you ask Mr. Douglas to tell us his own story." Mrs. Douglas gave a cry of astonishment at Holmes's words. The detectives and I must have echoed it, when we were aware of a man who seemed to have emerged from the wall, who advanced now from the gloom of the corner in which he had appeared. Mrs. Douglas turned, and in an instant her arms were round him. Barker had seized his outstretched hand. "It's best this way, Jack," his wife repeated. "I am sure that it is best." "Indeed, yes, Mr. Douglas," said Sherlock Holmes. "I am sure that you will find it best." The man stood blinking at us with the dazed look of one who comes from the dark into the light. It was a remarkable face, bold grey eyes, a strong, short-clipped, grizzled moustache, a square, projecting chin, and a humorous mouth. He took a good look at us all, and then, to my amazement, he advanced to me and handed me a bundle of paper. "I've heard of you," said he, in a voice which was not quite English and not quite American, but was altogether mellow and pleasing. "You are the historian of this bunch. Well, Dr. Watson, you've never had such a story as that pass through your hands before, and I'll lay my last dollar on that. Tell it your own way, but there are the facts. You can't miss the public so long as you have those. I've been cooped up 2 days, and I've spent the daylight hours, as much daylight as I could get in that rat trap, in putting the thing into words. You're welcome to them, you and your public. There's the story of the Valley of Fear." "That's the past, Mr. Douglas," said Sherlock Holmes quietly. "What we desire now is to hear your story of the present." "You'll have it, sir," said Douglas. "May I smoke as I talk? Well, thank you, Mr. Holmes. You're a smoker yourself, if I remember right, and you'll guess what it is to be sitting for 2 days with tobacco in your pocket and afraid that the smell will give you away." He leaned against the mantelpiece and sucked at the cigar which Holmes had handed him. "I've heard of you, Mr. Holmes. I never guessed that I should meet you. But before you are through with that," he nodded at my papers, "you will say I brought you something fresh." Inspector MacDonald had been staring at the newcomer with the greatest amazement. "Well, this fairly beats me," he cried at last. "If you are Mr. John Douglas of Birlstone Manor, then whose death have we been investigating for these 2 days, and where in the world have you sprung from now? You seem to me to come out of the floor like a jack-in-the-box." "Ah, Mr. Mac," said Holmes, shaking a reproving forefinger, "you would not read that excellent local compilation which described the concealment of King Charles. People did not hide in those days without excellent hiding places, and the hiding place that has once been used may be again. I had persuaded myself that we should find Mr. Douglas under this roof."
"And how long have you been playing this trick upon us, Mr. Holmes?" said the inspector angrily. "How long have you allowed us to waste ourselves upon a search that you knew to be an absurd one?"
"Not one instant, my dear Mr. Mac. Only last night did I form my views of the case. As they could not be put to the proof until this evening, I invited you and your colleague to take a holiday for the day. Pray, what more could I do? When I found the suit of clothes in the moat, it at once became apparent to me that the body we had found could not have been the body of Mr. John Douglas at all, but must be that of the bicyclist from Tunbridge Wells. No other conclusion was possible. Therefore, I had to determine where Mr. John Douglas himself could be, and the balance of probability was that with the connivance of his wife and his friend, he was concealed in a house which had such conveniences for a fugitive, and awaiting quieter times when he could make his final escape.
"Well, you figured it about right," said Douglas approvingly. "I thought I'd dodge your British law, for I was not sure how I stood under it, and also I saw my chance to throw these hounds once for all off my track. Mind you, from first to last, I have done nothing to be ashamed of, and nothing that I would not do again. But you'll judge that for yourselves when I tell you my story. Never mind warning me, Inspector. I'm ready to stand pat upon the truth. I'm not going to begin at the beginning. That's all there," he indicated my bundle of papers. "And a mighty queer yarn you'll find it. It all comes down to this, that there are some men that have good cause to hate me and would give their last dollar to know that they had got me. So long as I'm alive and they're alive, there is no safety in this world for me. They hunted me from Chicago to California, then they chased me out of America. But when I married and settled down in this quiet spot, I thought my last years were going to be peaceable. I never explained to my wife how things were. Why should I pull her into it? She would never have a quiet moment again, but would always be imagining trouble. I fancy she knew something, for I may have dropped a word here or a word there, but until yesterday, after you gentlemen had seen her, she never knew the rights of the matter. She told you all she knew, and so did Barker here, for on the night when this thing happened, there was mighty little time for explanations. She knows everything now, and I would have been a wiser man if I had told her sooner. But it was a hard question, dear." He took her hand for an instant in his own, and I acted for the best. "Well, gentlemen, the day before these happenings I was over in Tunbridge Wells, and I got a glimpse of a man in the street. It was only a glimpse, but I have a quick eye for these things, and I never doubted who it was. It was the worst enemy I had among them all, one who has been after me like a hungry wolf after a caribou all these years. I knew there was trouble coming, and I came home and made ready for it. I guessed I'd fight through it all right on my own. My luck was a proverb in the States about 76. I never doubted that it would be with me still. I was on my guard all that next day, and never went out into the park. It's as well, or he'd have had the drop on me with that buckshot gun of his before ever I could draw on him. After the bridge was up, my mind was always more restful when that bridge was up in the evenings, I put the thing clear out of my head. I never dreamed of his getting into the house and waiting for me. But when I made my round in my dressing gown, as was my habit, I had no sooner entered the study than I scented danger. I guess when a man has had dangers in his life, and I've had more than most in my time, there is a kind of sixth sense that waves the red flag. I saw the signal clear enough, yet I couldn't tell you why. Next instant I spotted a boot under the window curtain, and then I saw why, plain enough. I had just the one candle that was in my hand, but there was a good light from the hall lamp through the open door. I put down the candle and jumped for a hammer that I'd left on the mantel. At the same moment he sprang at me. I saw the glint of a knife, and I lashed at him with the hammer. I got him somewhere, for the knife tinkled down on the floor. He dodged round the table as quick as an eel, and a moment later he'd got his gun from under his coat. I heard him cock it. But I had got hold of it before he could fire. I had it by the barrel, and we wrestled for it, all ends up, for a minute or more.
It was death to the man that lost his grip. He never lost his grip, but he got it butt downward for a moment too long. Maybe it was I that pulled the trigger. Maybe we just jolted it off between us. Anyhow, he got both barrels in the face. And there I was, staring down at all that was left of Ted Baldwin. Tide recognized him in the township, and again when he sprang for me. But his own mother wouldn't recognize him as I saw him then. I'm used to rough work, and I fairly turned sick at the sight of him. I was hanging on the side of the table when Barker came hurrying down. I heard my wife coming, and I ran to the door and stopped her. It was no sight for a woman. I promised I'd come to her soon. I said a word or two to Barker. He took it all in at a glance, and we waited for the rest to come along. But there was no sign of them. Then we understood that they could hear nothing, and that all that had happened was known only to ourselves. It was at that instant that the idea came to me. I was fairly dazzled by the brilliance of it. The man's sleeve had slipped up, and there was the branded mark of the lodge upon his forearm. See, here! The man, whom we had known as Douglas, turned up his own coat and cuff to show a brown triangle within a circle exactly like that which we had seen upon the dead man. It was the sight of that which started me on it. I seemed to see it all clear at a glance. There were his height and hair and figure, about the same as my own. No one could swear to his face, poor devil. I brought down this suit of clothes, and in a quarter of an hour Barker and I had put my dressing gown on him, and he lay as you found him. We tied all his things into a bundle, and I weighted them with the only weight I could find, and put them through the window. The card he had meant to lay upon my body was lying beside his own. My rings were put on his finger, but when it came to the wedding ring, he held out his muscular hand. You can see for yourselves that I had struck the limit. I have not moved it since the day I was married, and it would have taken a file to get it off. I don't know anyhow that I should have cared to part with it. But if I had wanted to, I couldn't. So we just had to leave that detail to take care of itself. On the other hand, I brought a bit of plaster down and put it where I am wearing one myself at this instant. You slipped up there, Mr. Holmes, clever as you are, for if you had chanced to take off that plaster, you would have found no cut underneath it. Well, that was the situation. If I could lie low for a while and then get away where I could be joined by my widow, we should have a chance, at last, of living in peace for the rest of our lives. These devils would give me no rest so long as I was above ground, but if they saw in the papers that Baldwin had got his man, there would be an end of all my troubles. I hadn't much time to make it all clear to Barker and to my wife, but they understood enough to be able to help me. I knew all about this hiding place, so did Ames, but it never entered his head to connect it with the matter. I retired into it, and it was up to Barker to do the rest. I guess you can fill in for yourselves what he did. He opened the window and made the mark on the sill to give an idea of how the murderer escaped. It was a tall order, that, but as the bridge was up, there was no other way. Then, when everything was fixed, he rang the bell for all he was worth. What happened afterward, you know. And so, gentlemen, you can do what you please, but I've told you the truth and the whole truth, so help me God. What I ask you now is, how do I stand by the English law? There was a silence which was broken by Sherlock Holmes. The English law is, in the main, a just law. You will get no worse than your deserts from that, Mr. Douglas. But I would ask you, how did this man know that you lived here, or how to get into your house, or where to hide to get you? I know nothing of this. Holmes's face was very white and grave. The story is not over yet, I fear, said he. You may find worse dangers than the English law, or even than your enemies from America. I see trouble before you, Mr. Douglas. You'll take my advice and still be on your guard. And now, my long-suffering readers, I will ask you to come away with me for a time, far from the Sussex Manor House of Birlstone, and far also from the year of grace in which we made our eventful journey, which ended with the strange story of the man who had been known as John Douglas. I wish you to journey back some 20 years in time, and westward some thousands of miles in space, that I may lay before you a singular and terrible narrative, so singular and so terrible that you may find it hard to believe that even as I tell it, even so did it occur. Do not think that I intrude one story before another is finished. As you read on, you will find that this is not so. And when I have detailed those distant events, and you have solved this mystery of the past, we shall meet once more in those rooms on Baker Street, where this, like so many other wonderful happenings, will find its end. Part 2. The Scourers. Chapter 1. The Man. It was the 4th of February in the year 1875. It had been a severe winter, and the snow lay deep in the gorges of the Gilmerton Mountains. The steam ploughs had, however, kept the railroad open, and the evening train, which connects the long line of coal mining and iron-working settlements, was slowly groaning its way up the steep gradients which lead from Stagville on the plain to Vermissa, the central township, which lies at the head of Vermissa Valley. From this point, the track sweeps downward to Barton's Crossing, Helmdale, and the purely agricultural county of Merton. It was a single-track railroad, but at every siding, and they were numerous, long lines of trucks piled with coal and iron ore told of the hidden wealth which had brought a rude population and a bustling life to this most desolate corner of the United States of America. For desolate it was. Little could the first pioneer who had traversed it have ever imagined that the fairest prairies and the most lush water pastures were valueless compared to this gloomy land of black crag and tangled forest. Above the dark and often scarcely penetrable woods upon their flanks, the high, bare crowns of the mountains, white snow and jagged rock, towered upon each flank, leaving a long, winding, tortuous valley in the centre. Up this the little train was slowly crawling. The oil lamps had just been lit in the leading passenger car, a long, bare carriage in which some 20 or 30 people were seated. The greater number of these were workmen returning from their day's toil in the lower part of the valley. At least a dozen, by their grimed faces and the safety lanterns which they carried, proclaimed themselves miners. These sat smoking in a group and conversed in low voices, glancing occasionally at two men on the opposite side of the car, whose uniforms and badges showed them to be policemen. Several women of the labouring class and one or two travellers, who might have been small local storekeepers, made up the rest of the company, with the exception of one young man in a corner by himself. It is with this man that we are concerned. Take a good look at him, for he is worth it. He is a fresh-complexioned, middle-sized young man, not far, one would guess, from his 30th year. He has large, shrewd, humorous grey eyes, which twinkle inquiringly from time to time as he looks round through his spectacles at the people about him. It is easy to see that he is of a sociable and possibly simple disposition, anxious to be friendly to all men.
Anyone could pick him at once as gregarious in his habits and communicative in his nature, with a quick wit and a ready smile. And yet the man who studied him more closely might discern a certain firmness of jaw and grim tightness about the lips which would warn him that there were depths beyond, and that this pleasant, brown-haired young Irishman might conceivably leave his mark for good or evil upon any society to which he was introduced. Having made one or two tentative remarks to the nearest miner, and receiving only short, gruff replies, the traveller resigned himself to uncongenial silence, staring moodily out of the window at the fading landscape. It was not a cheering prospect. Through the growing gloom there pulsed the red glow of the furnaces on the sides of the hills. Great heaps of slag and dumps of cinders loomed up on each side, with the high shafts of the collieries towering above them. Huddled groups of mean wooden houses, the windows of which were beginning to outline themselves in light, were scattered here and there along the line, and the frequent halting places were crowded with their swarthy inhabitants. The iron and coal valleys of the Vermissa district were no resorts for the leisured or the cultured. Everywhere there were stern signs of the crudest battle of life, the rude work to be done, and the rude, strong workers who did it. The young traveller gazed out into this dismal country with a face of mingled repulsion and interest, which showed that the scene was new to him. At intervals he drew from his pocket a bulky letter to which he referred, and on the margins of which he scribbled some notes. Once, from the back of his waist, he produced something which one would hardly have expected to find in the possession of so mild-mannered a man. It was a navy revolver of the largest size. As he turned it slantwise to the light, the glint upon the rims of the copper shells within the drum showed that it was fully loaded. He quickly restored it to his secret pocket, but not before it had been observed by a working man who had seated himself upon the adjoining bench. "Hello, mate," said he. "You seem healed and ready." The young man smiled with an air of embarrassment. "Yes," said he. "We need them sometimes in the place I come from." "And where might that be?" "I'm last from Chicago." "A stranger in these parts?" "Yes." "You may find you need it here," said the workman. "Ah, is that so?" The young man seemed interested. "Have you heard nothing of doings hereabouts? Nothing out of the way?" "Why, I thought the country was full of it. You'll hear quick enough. What made you come here?" "I heard there was always work for a willing man." "Are you a member of the union?" "Sure." "Then you'll get your job, I guess." "Have you any friends?" "Not yet, but I have the means of making them." "How's that, then?" "I am one of the eminent order of freemen. There is no town without a lodge, and where there is a lodge, I'll find my friends." The remark had a singular effect upon his companion. He glanced round suspiciously at the others in the car. The miners were still whispering among themselves. The two police officers were dozing. He came across, seated himself close to the young traveller, and held out his hand. "Put it there," he said. A hand grip passed between the two. "I see you speak the truth," said the workman, "but it's well to make certain." He raised his right hand to his right eyebrow. The traveller at once raised his left hand to his left eyebrow. "Dark nights are unpleasant," said the workman. "Yes, for strangers to travel," the other answered. "That's good enough. I'm Brother Scanlon, Lodge 341, Vermissa Valley. Glad to see you in these parts." "Thank you. I'm Brother John McMurdo, Lodge 29, Chicago, Bodymaster J.H. Scott. But I'm in luck to meet a brother so early." "Well, there are plenty of us about. You won't find the order more flourishing anywhere in the States than right here in Vermissa Valley. But we could do with some lads like you.
I can't understand a spry man of the Union finding no work to do in Chicago.
I found plenty of work to do, said McMurdo.
Then why did you leave?
McMurdo nodded towards the policeman and smiled.
I guess those chaps would be glad to know, he said.
Scanlon groaned sympathetically.
In trouble?
He asked in a whisper.
Deep.
A penitentiary job?
And the rest.
Not a killing.
It's early days to talk of such things, said McMurdo, with the air of a man who had been surprised into saying more than he intended.
I've my own good reasons for leaving Chicago. Let that be enough for you.
Who are you that you should take it on yourself to ask such things?
His grey eyes gleamed with sudden and dangerous anger from behind his glasses.
All right, mate, no offence meant. The boys will think none the worse of you, whatever you may have done. Where are you bound for now?
Vermissa.
That's the third halt down the line. Where are you staying?
McMurdo took out an envelope and held it close to the murky oil lamp.
Here is the address, Jacob Shafter, Sheridan Street. It's a boarding house that was recommended by a man I knew in Chicago.
Well, I don't know it, but Vermissa is out of my beat. I live at Hobson's Patch, and that's here where we're drawing up.
But say, there is one bit of advice I'll give you before we part. If you're in trouble in Vermissa, go straight to the Union House and see Boss McGinty. He is the bodymaster of Vermissa Lodge, and nothing can happen in these parts unless Black Jack McGinty wants it.
So long, mate. Maybe we'll meet in Lodge one of these evenings, but mind my words. If you're in trouble, go to Boss McGinty.
Scanlon descended, and McMurdo was left once again to his thoughts. Night had now fallen, and the flames of the frequent furnaces were roaring and leaping in the darkness. Against their lurid background, dark figures were bending and straining, twisting and turning, with the motion of winch or of windlass, to the rhythm of an eternal clank and roar.
I guess hell must look something like that, said a voice.
McMurdo turned and saw that one of the policemen had shifted in his seat and was staring out into the fiery waste.
For that matter, said the other policeman, I allow that hell must be something like that. If there are worse devils down yonder than some we could name, it's more than I'd expect.
I guess you are new to this part, young man.
Well, what if I am? McMurdo answered in a surly voice.
Just this, mister, that I should advise you to be careful in choosing your friends. I don't think I'd begin with Mike Scanlon or his gang if I were you.
What the hell is it to you? Who are my friends? Roared McMurdo, in a voice which brought every head in the carriage round to witness the altercation.
Did I ask you for your advice? Or did you think me such a sucker that I wouldn't move without it? You speak when you're spoken to, and by the Lord you'll have to wait a long time if it was me.
He thrust out his face and grinned at the patrolman like a snarling dog.
The two policemen, heavy, good-natured men, were taken aback by the extraordinary vehemence with which their friendly advances had been rejected.
No offence, stranger, said one. It was a warning for your own good, seeing that you are, by your own showing, new to the place.
I'm new to the place, but I'm not new to you and your kind, cried McMurdo in cold fury. I guess you're the same in all places, shoving your advice in when nobody asks for it.
Maybe we'll see more of you before very long, said one of the patrolmen with a grin.
You're a real hand-picked one, if I'm a judge.
I was thinking the same, remarked the other. I guess we may meet again.
I'm not afraid of you, and don't you think it, cried McMurdo. My name's Jack McMurdo, see? If you want me, you'll find me at Jacob Shafter's on Sheridan Street for Missa. So I'm not hiding from you, am I? Day or night, I dare to look the like of you in the face. Don't make any mistake about that.
There was a murmur of sympathy and admiration from the miners at the dauntless demeanour of the newcomer, while the two policemen shrugged their shoulders and renewed a conversation between themselves.
A few minutes later, the train ran into the ill-lit station, and there was a general clearing, for Vermissa was by far the largest town on the line. McMurdo picked up his leather gripsack and was about to start off into the darkness when one of the miners accosted him. "By gar, mate, you know how to speak to the cops," he said in a voice of awe. "It was grand to hear you. Let me carry your grip and show you the road. I'm passing Shafters on the way to my own shack." There was a chorus of friendly good nights from the other miners as they passed from the platform. Before ever he had set foot in it, McMurdo the Turbulent had become a character in Vermissa. The country had been a place of terror, but the town was in its way even more depressing. Down that long valley there was at least a certain gloomy grandeur in the huge fires and the clouds of drifting smoke, while the strength and industry of man found fitting monuments in the hills which he had spilled by the side of his monstrous excavations. But the town showed a dead level of mean ugliness and squalor. The broad street was churned up by the traffic into a horrible, rutted paste of muddy snow. The sidewalks were narrow and uneven. The numerous gas lamps served only to show more clearly a long line of wooden houses, each with its veranda facing the street, unkempt and dirty. As they approached the centre of the town, the scene was brightened by a row of well-lit stores, and even more by a cluster of saloons and gaming houses, in which the miners spent their hard-earned but generous wages. "That's the Union House," said the guide, pointing to one saloon which rose almost to the dignity of being a hotel. "Jack McGinty is the boss there."
"What sort of a man is he?" McMurdo asked.
"What, have you never heard of the boss?"
"How could I have heard of him when you know that I'm a stranger in these parts?"
"Well, I thought his name was known clear across the country. It's been in the papers often enough."
"What for?"
"Well,"
the miner lowered his voice,
"over the affairs."
"What affairs?"
"Good Lord, mister, you are queer, if I must say it without offence. There's only one set of affairs that you'll hear of in these parts, and that's the affairs of the Scourers."
"Why, I seem to have read of the Scourers in Chicago. A gang of murderers, are they not?"
"Hush on your life!" cried the miner, standing still in alarm and gazing in amazement at his companion. "Man, you won't live long in these parts if you speak in the open street like that. Many a man has had the life beaten out of him for less."
"Well, I know nothing about them. It's only what I've read."
"And I'm not saying that you've not read the truth."
The man looked nervously round him as he spoke, peering into the shadows as if he feared to see some lurking danger.
"If killing is murder, then God knows there is murder and to spare. But don't you dare to breathe the name of Jack McGinty in connection with it, stranger. For every whisper goes back to him, and he is not one that is likely to let it pass. Now, that's the house you're after, that one standing back from the street. You'll find old Jacob Shafter that runs it as honest a man as lives in this township."
"Why, thank you," said McMurdo, and shaking hands with his new acquaintance, he plodded, gripsack in hand, up the path which led to the dwelling-house, at the door of which he gave a resounding knock. It was opened at once by someone very different from what he had expected. It was a woman, young and singularly beautiful. She was of the German type, blonde and fair-haired, with the piquant contrast of a pair of beautiful dark eyes with which she surveyed the stranger with surprise and a pleasing embarrassment which brought a wave of colour over her pale face. Framed in the bright light of the open doorway, it seemed to McMurdo that he had never seen a more beautiful picture, the more attractive for its contrast with the sordid and gloomy surroundings. A lovely violet, growing upon one of those black slag heaps of the mines, would not have seemed more surprising.
So entranced was he that he stood staring without a word, and it was she who broke the silence.
"I thought it was father," said she, with a pleasing little touch of a German accent. "Did you come to see him? He is downtown. I expect him back every minute."
McMurdo continued to gaze at her in open admiration until her eyes dropped in confusion before this masterful visitor. "No, miss," he said at last, "I'm in no hurry to see him. But your house was recommended to me for board. I thought it might suit me, and now I know it will." "You are quick to make up your mind," said she with a smile. "Anyone but a blind man could do as much," the other answered. She laughed at the compliment. "Come right in, sir," she said. "I'm Miss Etty Shafter, Mr. Shafter's daughter. My mother's dead, and I run the house. You can sit down by the stove in the front room until father comes along. Ah, here he is. So you can fix things with him right away." A heavy, elderly man came plodding up the path. In a few words, McMurdo explained his business. A man of the name of Murphy had given him the address in Chicago. He, in turn, had had it from someone else. Old Shafter was quite ready. The stranger made no bones about terms, agreed at once to every condition, and was apparently fairly flush of money. For $7 a week paid in advance, he was to have board and lodging. So it was that McMurdo, the self-confessed fugitive from justice, took up his abode under the roof of the Shafters, the first step which was to lead to so long and dark a train of events, ending in a far distant land. Chapter 2. The Body Master. McMurdo was a man who made his mark quickly. Wherever he was, the folk around soon knew it. Within a week, he had become infinitely the most important person at Shafter's. There were 10 or 12 boarders there, but they were honest foremen or commonplace clerks from the stores, of a very different caliber from the young Irishman. Of an evening, when they gathered together, his joke was always the readiest, his conversation the brightest, and his song the best. He was a born boon companion, with a magnetism which drew good humour from all around him. And yet he showed again and again, as he had shown in the railway carriage, a capacity for sudden, fierce anger, which compelled the respect and even the fear of those who met him. For the law, too, and all who were connected with it, he exhibited a bitter contempt, which delighted some and alarmed others of his fellow boarders. From the first, he made it evident by his open admiration that the daughter of the house had won his heart from the instant that he had set eyes upon her beauty and her grace. He was no backward suitor. On the second day, he told her that he loved her, and from then onward he repeated the same story with an absolute disregard of what she might say to discourage him. "Someone else," he would cry. "Well, the worse luck for someone else. Let him look out for himself. Am I to lose my life's chance and all my heart's desire for someone else? You can keep on saying no, Etty. The day will come when you will say yes, and I'm young enough to wait." He was a dangerous suitor, with his glib Irish tongue and his pretty coaxing ways. There was about him also that glamour of experience and of mystery which attracts a woman's interest and finally her love. He could talk of the sweet valleys of County Monaghan from which he came, of the lovely distant island, the low hills and green meadows, of which seemed the more beautiful when imagination viewed them from this place of grime and snow. Then he was versed in the life of the cities of the North, of Detroit, and the lumber camps of Michigan, and finally of Chicago, where he had worked in a planing mill. And afterwards came the hint of romance, the feeling that strange things had happened to him in that great city, so strange and so intimate that they might not be spoken of. He spoke wistfully of a sudden leaving, a breaking of old ties, a flight into a strange world, ending in this dreary valley. And Etty listened, her dark eyes gleaming with pity and with sympathy, those two qualities which may turn so rapidly and so naturally to love. McMurdo had obtained a temporary job as bookkeeper, for he was a well-educated man. This kept him out most of the day, and he had not found occasion yet to report himself to the head of the lodge of the Eminent Order of Freemen. He was reminded of his omission, however, by a visit one evening from Mike Scanlon, the fellow member whom he had met in the train. Scanlon, the small, sharp-faced, nervous, black-eyed man, seemed glad to see him once more. After a glass or two of whiskey, he broached the object of his visit. "Say, McMurdo," said he, "I remembered your address, so I made bold to call. I'm surprised that you've not reported to the bodymaster. Why haven't you seen Boss McGinty yet?" "Well, I had to find a job. I've been busy." "You must find time for him if you have none for anything else. Good Lord, man, you're a fool not to have been down to the Union House and registered your name the first morning after you came here. If you run against him—" "Well, you mustn't, that's all." McMurdo showed mild surprise. "I've been a member of the lodge for over 2 years, Scanlon, but I never heard the duties were so pressing as all that."
"Maybe not in Chicago."
"Well, it's the same society here."
"Is it?"
Scanlon looked at him long and fixedly. There was something sinister in his eyes.
"Isn't it?"
"You'll tell me that in a month's time.
I hear you had a talk with the patrolman after I left the train."
"How did you know that?"
"Oh, it got about. Things do get about for good and for bad in this district."
"Well, yes. I told the hounds what I thought of them."
"By the Lord, you'll be a man after McGinty's heart.
What, does he hate the police too?"
Scanlon burst out laughing.
"You go and see him, my lad," said he, as he took his leave. "It's not the police, but you that he'll hate if you don't. Now, take a friend's advice and go at once."
It chanced that on the same evening McMurdo had another more pressing interview which urged him in the same direction. It may have been that his attentions to Etty had been more evident than before, or that they had gradually obtruded themselves into the slow mind of his good German host. But whatever the cause, the boarding-house keeper beckoned the young man into his private room and started on the subject without any circumlocution.
"It seems to me, mister," said he, "that you are getting set on my Etty. Ain't that so, or am I wrong?"
"Yes, that is so," the young man answered.
"Well, I want to tell you right now that it ain't no manner of use. There's someone slipped in afore you."
"She told me so."
"Well, you can lay that she told you truth, but did she tell you who it was?"
"No, I asked her, but she wouldn't tell."
"I dare say not, the little baggage. Perhaps she did not wish to frighten you away."
"Frighten?" McMurdo was on fire in a moment.
"Ah, yes, my friend. You need not be ashamed to be frightened of him. It is Teddy Baldwin."
"And who the devil is he?"
"He is a boss of Scourers."
"Scourers? I've heard of them before. It's Scourers here and Scourers there, and always in a whisper. What are you all afraid of? Who are the Scourers?"
The boarding-house keeper instinctively sank his voice, as everyone did who talked about that terrible society.
"The Scourers," said he, "are the Eminent Order of Freemen."
The young man stared.
"Why, I'm a member of that order myself."
"You? I would never have had you in my house if I had known it, not if you were to pay me $100 a week."
"What's wrong with the order? It's for charity and good fellowship. The rules say so."
"Maybe in some places, not here."
"Oh, what is it here?"
It's a murder society. That's what it is.
McMurdo laughed incredulously.
How can you prove that? He asked. Prove it? Are there not 50 murders to prove it? What about Milman and Van Schorst and the Nicholson family and old Mr. Hyam and little Billy James and others? Prove it. Is there a man or a woman in this valley what does not know it?
See here, said McMurdo earnestly, I want you to take back what you've said, or else make it good. One or the other you must do before I quit this room.
Put yourself in my place. Here am I, a stranger in the town. I belong to a society that I know only as an innocent one. You'll find it through the length and breadth of the states, but always as an innocent one. Now, when I'm counting upon joining it here, you tell me that it is the same as a murder society called the Scourers. I guess you owe me either an apology or else an explanation, Mr. Shafter.
I can but tell you what the whole world knows, mister. The bosses of the one are the bosses of the other. If you offend the one, it is the other that will strike you. We have proved it too often.
That's just gossip. I want proof, said McMurdo.
If you live here long, you will get your proof. But I forget that you are yourself one of them. You will soon be as bad as the rest. But you will find other lodgings, mister. I cannot have you here. It is not bad enough that one of these people come courting my Etty, and that I dare not turn him down, but that I should have another for my boarder? Yes, indeed. You shall not sleep here after tonight.
McMurdo found himself under sentence of banishment, both from his comfortable quarters and from the girl whom he loved. He found her alone in the sitting room that same evening, and he poured his troubles into her ear. "Sure your father is after giving me notice," he said. "It's little I would care if it was just my room, but indeed, Etty, though it's only a week that I've known you, you are the very breath of life to me, and I can't live without you."
"Oh, hush, Mr. McMurdo, don't speak so," said the girl. "I have told you, have I not, that you are too late? There is another, and if I have not promised to marry him at once, at least I can promise no one else."
"Suppose I had been first, Etty. Would I have had a chance?" The girl sank her face into her hands.
"I wish to heaven that you had been first," she sobbed.
McMurdo was down on his knees before her in an instant.
"For God's sake, Etty, let it stand at that!" he cried. "Will you ruin your life and my own for the sake of this promise? Follow your heart, Acushla. 'Tis a safer guide than any promise before you knew what it was that you were saying."
He had seized Etty's white hand between his own strong brown ones.
"Say that you will be mine, and we will face it out together."
"Not here?"
"Yes, here. No, no, Jack."
His arms were round her now.
"It could not be here. Could you take me away?"
A struggle passed for a moment over McMurdo's face, but it ended by setting like granite.
"No, here," he said. "I'll hold you against the world, Etty, right here where we are." "Why should we not leave together?"
"No, Etty, I can't leave here."
"But why?"
"I'd never hold my head up again if I felt that I'd been driven out. Besides, what is there to be afraid of? Are we not free folks in a free country? If you love me, and I you, who will dare to come between?"
"You don't know, Jack. You've been here too short a time. You don't know this Baldwin. You don't know McGinty and his Scourers."
"No, I don't know them, and I don't fear them, and I don't believe in them," said McMurdo. "I've lived among rough men, my darling, and instead of fearing them, it has always ended that they have feared me. Always, Etty.
It's mad on the face of it. If these men, as your father says, have done crime after crime in the valley, and if everyone knows them by name, how comes it that none are brought to justice? You answer me that, Etty." "Because no witness dares to appear against them. He would not live a month if he did. Also, because they have always their own men to swear that the accused one was far from the scene of the crime.
But surely, Jack, you must have read all this. I had understood that every paper in the United States was writing about it.
Well, I have read something, it's true, but I had thought it was a story.
Maybe these men have some reason in what they do. Maybe they are wronged and have no other way to help themselves.
Oh, Jack, don't let me hear you speak so. That is how he speaks, the other one.
Baldwin, he speaks like that, does he?
And that is why I loathe him so. Oh, Jack, now I can tell you the truth. I loathe him with all my heart, but I fear him also. I fear him for myself, but above all I fear him for Father. I know that some great sorrow would come upon us if I dared to say what I really felt. That is why I have put him off with half promises. It was, in real truth, our only hope. But if you would fly with me, Jack, we could take Father with us and live forever far from the power of these wicked men.
Again there was the struggle upon McMurdo's face, and again it set like granite. No harm shall come to you, Etty, nor to your father either. As to wicked men, I expect you may find that I am as bad as the worst of them before we're through.
No, no, Jack, I would trust you anywhere.
McMurdo laughed bitterly. Good Lord, how little you know of me. Your innocent soul, my darling, could not even guess what is passing in mine. But hello, who's the visitor? The door had opened suddenly, and a young fellow came swaggering in with the air of one who is the master. He was a handsome, dashing young man of about the same age and build as McMurdo himself. Under his broad-brimmed black felt hat, which he had not troubled to remove, a handsome face with fierce, domineering eyes and a curved hawk-bill of a nose looked savagely at the pair who sat by the stove. Etty had jumped to her feet, full of confusion and alarm.
"I'm glad to see you, Mr. Baldwin," said she. "You're earlier than I had thought. Come and sit down."
Baldwin stood with his hands on his hips, looking at McMurdo. "Who is this?" he asked curtly.
"It's a friend of mine, Mr. Baldwin, a new boarder here. Mr. McMurdo, may I introduce you to Mr. Baldwin?"
The young men nodded in surly fashion to each other. "Maybe Miss Addy has told you how it is with us," said Baldwin. "I didn't understand that there was any relation between you." "Didn't you? Well, you can understand it now. You can take it from me that this young lady is mine, and you'll find it a very fine evening for a walk."
"Thank you. I'm in no humour for a walk."
"Aren't you?" The man's savage eyes were blazing with anger. "Maybe you're in a humour for a fight, Mr. Border." "That I am," cried McMurdo, springing to his feet. "You never said a more welcome word."
"For God's sake, Jack, oh, for God's sake," cried poor, distracted Etty. "Oh, Jack, Jack, he will hurt you."
"Oh, it's Jack, is it?" said Baldwin with an oath. "You've come to that already, have you?"
"Oh, Ted, be reasonable, be kind, for my sake, Ted. If ever you loved me, be big-hearted and forgiving."
"I think, Etty, that if you were to leave us alone, we could get this thing settled," said McMurdo quietly. "Or maybe, Mr. Baldwin, you will take a turn down the street with me. It's a fine evening, and there's some open ground beyond the next block." "I'll get even with you without needing to dirty my hands," said his enemy. "You'll wish you had never set foot in this house before I am through with you."
"No time like the present," cried McMurdo.
"I'll choose my own time, mister. You can leave the time to me. See here." He suddenly